and listen for the sound of hoofbeats on the ice.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those nights in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the field that it ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the wars against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA. It's coming through a crack in the wall on a visionary flood of alcohol. From the staggering account of the Sermon on the Mount, which I don't pretend to understand at all. It's coming from the silence on the dock of the bay, from the brave, the bold, the battered heart of Chevrolet. Democracy is coming to the USA. Sail on, O mighty ship of state, to the shores of need, past the reefs of greed, through the squalls of hate. Sail on, sail on, sail on. I'm sentimental, if you know what I mean. I love the country, but I can't stand the scene. And I'm neither left or right. I'm just staying home tonight, getting lost in that hopeless little screen. But I'm stubborn as those garbage bags that time cannot decay. I'm junk, but I'm still holding up this little wild bouquet. Democracy is coming to the USA. Of course, it doesn't actually look like democracy is coming here or anywhere else. Our rogue state is certainly trying its best to bring something it calls democracy to the rest of the world, but we know it is far from that. We know it's a lot closer to fascism than democracy. And so it goes. I'm Chuck Gregory, and this is the New American Dream Radio Show. And we are streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We're glad you're listening tonight. We hope you'll be back every Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m. right here on the Studio B stream from Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Don't forget to visit freedomslips.com to help support this excellent listener-supported network. And now, I'm proud to introduce my friend and co-host, Mike Palachek, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight we welcome special guests Richard Flamer, Jim Fetzer, Susan Lindauer, and Phil Ferruggio. And so tonight we are joined together for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Port Orange, Tacoma Park, Madison, Chiapas, and wherever you are. I want to mention an article on Veterans Today about Paul McCartney being dead. There's a look for slugfest between Fetzer and Barrett regarding the issue of whether Paul McCartney is dead. And you can also look for a follow-up radio show on No Lies Radio, again featuring Fetzer and Barrett, about the issue of whether or not Paul McCartney died in 1966. Now I would like to mention again Dave McGowan, his book, Program to Kill. I am reading the book. It's not new, but it's new to me. I think it's an important book and gives us more insights into how far this whole false history, false reality has gone, and for how long. This is me to Dave McGowan. Hello, I'm reading your book. I picked up The Hitchhiker near Spirit Lake, Iowa, a few years ago, and he related a story about having been taken from an orphanage when he was young. Trained to Kill, went to Vietnam, maybe Project Phoenix, I don't know. And he also talked about a trigger jingle like a TV commercial, maybe the Clairol commercial. It's been a while. I guess I was hoping that commercial did not come on the radio while we were driving. But anyway, that's why I picked up your book. I wanted to try to understand who that guy was. It's all pretty amazing, and I think you have helped us get a little farther in understanding. Well, anyway, with Program to Kill, you made me think deeper about how far the deception goes. I never even considered that the serial killer phenomenon of past decades might be faked or a setup. It does seem they have gone to another method. I just can't understand the why on a personal level. I can understand the gladiatorial concept, but still on a human level, the why is hard to really get to. And from McGowan, back to me, yeah, serial killers have definitely faded from the national landscape, essentially replaced with spree killers, domestic terrorists, and no one really questions why serial killers suddenly became commonplace in the 70s, why they have now faded away, and why spree killers are now part of the domestic fabric of life. People just accept such things as the new reality without asking the obvious questions. McGowan, Program to Kill is an alternative look at violent crime in 20th century America. This may seem at first glance like a radical departure from my previous books, until one realizes that in this modern world that we inhabit, there is no discernible difference between crime and politics. If you aren't yet convinced of that, you might be after you finish reading this book. And here are some comments from others on the book. One last thing, David himself has pointed out in interviews that serial killers have seemingly disappeared. It's been 20 years since they made news. Since then, mass shootings have become common. It's interesting how serial killers came and went. The author only hints at there being an established operation for programming serial killers. More comments. Program to Kill should be read by every truth seeker who can handle it. It's amazing to live in these times as the veils are lifted all around us. I used to think that anything satanic was just a joke, like some of the negative reviewers who probably did not read the book. I remember the media circuses around the Boston Strangler, Richard Speck, and others, and it's clear the media purposely see no deeper evil. They did a lot of research that mainstream media would never touch. After all, influencing public opinion to make democracy safe for fascism is their job. People who have awakened since 9/11 can understand the strategy of tension as revealed about the Gladio program. Keep the public scared so the authorities gain absolute power. It's hard to read and hard to put down this book. It's very well documented and reveals the most scary side of how evil criminals are used by government to demoralize the public. We cannot hide from the fact that our government kidnaps and tortures people. This is a very important book. Read it. This book will blow your mind. It will literally change how you view our society. It's full of information pertaining to all of the serial murder cases in recent history, shocking information that was omitted from the mainstream media coverage. The overwhelming evidence shows that these high-profile cases were covered up, smoothed over, with one fall guy to shoulder all the blame while keeping the other murderers free. Also shows the many connections these killers had to government military mind control. This is a must-read for anyone seeking the truth. I need not look beyond this courtroom to see all the liars, the haters, the killers, the crooks, the paranoid cowards. We are all expendable for a cause. No one knows that better than those who keep policy clandestinely or openly, as do the governments of the world, which kill in the name of God and country. That's Richard the Night Stalker Ramirez. The crime scenes of the Phoenix program were indistinguishable from the crime scenes of American serial killers. The goals of psychological warfare are no different here at home than they were in Southeast Asia or Asia or Central America, to scare the people, in this case the American people, into willingly surrendering their rights and accepting ever-increasing levels of repression, and to desensitize the people to horrendous levels of interpersonal violence. The ultimate goal, one that we are rapidly approaching, is the destruction of all social bonds, of any remaining sense of community, the complete atomization of society. Okay, well then, it is again time for the George Carlin, St. Patrick's Day, Target and Walmart, spring break, end of the year, special sale on folders and pencils and lunchboxes and backpacks. Tell your children's teachers and principals and school boards what you really think about them in their little school and little classroom with these special messages on the pencils and folders and lunchboxes and backpacks that will fall apart conveniently before next fall, so you can buy more cheap crap from Walmart and Target, your school supplies buddies. some sample selections from the George Carlin Target Walmart Mardi Gras St. Patrick's Day spring break end of the year. Get rid of all that cheap school stuff. Now special sale on folders and pencils and lunchbox and backpacks. Get a pack of 100 number 2 pencils with this special little message that your child can see every time she tries to calculate 2 plus 2.
There's a reason that education sucks. It's never going to be fixed. There's nothing you can do about it. The owners of this country don't want that. They don't want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking, well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. They're not interested in that. That doesn't help them.
Get a new backpack with this message for everyone on the bus.
They don't want people who are smart enough to sit around the kitchen table and figure out how badly they're getting screwed by a system that threw them overboard 30 freaking years ago. They don't want that.
Take home 20 multicolored notebooks and folders to hold all your child's important papers with this familiar old American saying.
You know what they want? They want obedient workers, people who are just smart enough to run the machine to do the paperwork and just dumb enough to passively accept all these increasingly crappier jobs with the lower pay, the longer hours, the reduced benefits, the end of overtime, and the vanishing pension that disappears the minute you go to collect it. They own this freaking place. It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
The ballparks and swimming pools are defrosting. The ice cream and popsicles are being dragged from the freezer. Yes, it's that time again. Time for the George Carlin Target and Walmart Mardi Gras St. Patrick's Day spring break end-of-the-year special sale on folders and pencils and lunch boxes and backpacks from your school supplies buddies at Target and Walmart. Our first guest of the night is Richard Flamer. Richard Flamer lives and works at the Chiapas, Mexico Catholic Worker. And we are so lucky to be able to speak to Richard on the second week of every month. Richard is a Chuck will be getting Richard on the phone just pretty soon here. And Richard is a Vietnam veteran. He's a, what else has he done? He was a photographer, a war photographer for Reuters in Central America for many years. He was a rare book dealer.
Hey, bueno.
Well, hello, Richard. It's Chuck and Mike and the New American Dream Radio Show, and you are on the air.
Oh, well, thank you. I did mean to mention also along the way that I'm really grateful for the opportunity to express what, in most cases, are my ideas, thoughts, observations, and sometimes pleas from Chiapas. Quite often, as I've mentioned in the past, occasionally I feel isolated down here, in part because I don't speak English for weeks on end. Everything's in Spanish. And it's so much harder to find the right words in Spanish than it is in English for me. And so sometimes I get frustrated, and this has been a wonderful outlet for me to be able to speak. I wanted to just sort of briefly this month, talk about life here. And I don't mean to be constantly talking about the violence and the disorder here, but it's such a regular thing. I lose sight of the fact that the violence is really everywhere in the world, but here it's so close to us. as I mentioned last month, the little child who got run over, whom we buried up behind our property in a little cemetery for the community. Those kinds of deaths are pretty common. They don't have the safeguards. We don't have the safeguards down here that there are in the U.S., although a child can be run over anywhere, obviously. But here it tends to be so much closer, and in part because the communities are so much more coherent. On the day of that funeral for the child, there are now 120 families in our little community, and there were 118 members of those families, that 120 at the funeral, which gives some credence to the idea that it is a community. And there are, of course, problems, social ills and all that sort of thing here too, but still there's something about the cohesiveness that pleases me. Here on the farm, Araceli and I have almost finished with the apartment and her workshop. I've been working on cabinets for storage using wood from a 60-foot pine that we cut down 4 months ago. The tree was infected with worms eating at the roots and starting to bend too close to the house. So I cut it down and a neighbor came over with a chainsaw. I cut the tree down with my chainsaw, but he's an expert at cutting out planks and beams and that sort of thing. So he cut those out, and then I let the wood dry for 4 months. And now I've been planing it and using it for cabinets. Along with the woodwork, we saved enough money to buy a full-size refrigerator. But what my wife failed to tell me was that she didn't want it in the corner where it was, where the other one was, but in the space that housed the cabinet. So I ended up having to tear out three of the cabinets. And so I've been rebuilding those as well as the countertops. House is now completely painted and a new fence built to keep the dogs from running away. And I've been starting on the framework of a website for my wife and her cooperative of Indian women who make organic products and some native medicines, some tinctures and organic shampoo and organic soaps and so forth. And it's pretty interesting because I'm discovering that there are some words in Spanish which are not in English. That is, there are some plants down here that one doesn't have back up in the States. So I'm struggling to interpret all that stuff. I've made two other trips to Guatemala to visit the camp called the Alambajos to work with the repatriated refugees and their carpentry shop. A blacktop road goes to the Guatemalan border. And that trip takes about 2 hours and is about 110 miles. From the Guatemalan-Mexican border, the trip is only about 30 miles. But the road is so bad that it takes 3.5 hours on a good day to get to the village. With rain falling 10 months a year, the route is pure mud with some holes, sinkholes, as deep as 2 foot. Trips were about arranging for a transformer for the wood shop. I took an Austrian architect whom I've worked with in the past over to Alambajos, and he agreed to pay for the new transformer. But to actually get it installed, it's proving a cumbersome process. It's not installed yet, but it's almost there. The big problem is that it's about 6 hours from Guatemala City, and all the bigger companies are in Guatemala City. So the people are trying to figure out how to get there and get a crew up of four guys to put in a post and put in the transformer and run it onto the main line. The costs are, at this stage, not a problem. The problem's the logistics more than anything. When it's installed, we've got two young men trained to operate the machinery, so they can finally get to work. We brought two fellows over from Guatemala to San Cristobal here and put them in a wood shop that's also a school, and they stayed for 2 weeks. They're both accomplished carpenters, but working only with hand tools. Now they understand the basics of running a planer and a table saw. And so those things they'll be able to run as soon as the transformer is in. And that doesn't sound like much, but you're talking about 300 families and with only two carpenters in the village. That's not much. And they're eager to get to work. So we're trying awfully hard to get the transformer installed and get them up and running. I've been preparing for a trip to the U.S. in April. A lot of things to get done before I leave, but mostly I've been thinking about why I don't like returning to the country where I was born. We down here get news that's from Mexico, but it, of course, includes a lot of American activities. And we heard about the killing of the street person in L.A., and of course, the killing of the black man in Ferguson, Missouri. And the racism, which I will get back to in a minute, but it's always about the white and black, and everything's in black and white. Mexico still suffers from 10,000 to 15,000 killings a year, mostly related to the drug violence. And, of course, the U.S. has done nothing to dampen the demand for the drugs. So the cartels fight over trade routes. And although an irony of all that is that we just heard recently that a shipment of Colorado marijuana was received in Baja California. And so it's actually going the other way as well. The ambition of and the capitalism of the U.S. leave me nonplussed. I don't understand the constant striving for money. And it isn't to say that I dislike money, but it just seems to me that there are more important things in the world than the pursuit of money. We have down here an active spiritual life, and I have active friendships with a good dozen people, working people. I spent today, part of the day, working with a mechanic and explaining a training manual, or a manual, actually a technical manual, translating it from English to Spanish for him. He's a fine mechanic. He just doesn't know how to read in English. And it's a fairly new car that he was working on. So it was a little complicated. But somehow that seems more important than trying to work for money. And I'm always surprised that there's such good people around me and when I go back to the U.S., but I just can't get away from the politics and the everything in those people that I deal with in the U.S. For them, almost everything is in terms of black and white. Why is socialism such a bad thing? Why is communism a bad thing? When it's taken to extremes, anything's bad. But to my mind, there's a lot of good can come of working in a socialist fashion. But the other odd thing about all this is that as I get closer to leaving, it's been my history over the last 10 years, 15 really, that when I get close to leaving for the U.S., my dreams are in English, and the rest of the time they're in Spanish. And then when I'm up in the States and getting ready to come back, I know when it's time to come back when I start dreaming in Spanish again. And so lately I've been dreaming in English. Finally, I just finished a book called The Ringside Seat to a Revolution by David Dorado Romo. And it's about a sort of micro history of El Paso, Texas, and the problems there of not just of a border town, but of the problems of the racism and so forth. And I wanted to quote from a little part of his book. It says the story of Rosa Parks refusing to move to the colored section of the bus has become a central drama of the American experience, and rightly so. But the story of 17-year-old Carmelita Torres, who in 1917 refused to get off the El Paso Juarez trolley to be deloused, bathed in kerosene, and have her head shaved by U.S. immigration authorities, has never been told. Why is her experience also not a part of the American consciousness? Again, it's that sort of issue of black and white, and what happened to the brown people in the middle. That's all for this month.
Richard, that was fascinating. Thank you so much.
And again, my thanks for the opportunity to speak out.
Would you remind our listeners of the address where they can send donations?
Sure. It's the Chiapas Project, care of Holy Family Catholic Church, 1715 Izzard, Izard Street, Omaha, Nebraska, 68102. And let's hear it for the Catholic Church. Great folks, especially the ones down here. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Richard. We really appreciate having you on the show. And we'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And now, from the actual American History Channel, tonight we will hear an excerpt from the book Disturbing the Peace, sponsored by Powder Milk Democrat Gonads. Heavens, they're pasty. Voice for the Voiceless, Fort Benning, Georgia, August 9th, 1983. The summer sun was finally setting. It was time to act, time to engage the Salvadoran troops. Roy Bourgeois was ready, but he was not so sure that Larry Rosebaugh could penetrate base security. Rosebaugh, a gentle oblate priest who had worked with street people in Brazil, reminded Bourgeois of St. Francis. Even in the battle dress uniform Bourgeois had purchased for him at the local army surplus store, Rosebaugh did not exactly present a military bearing. It would take a small miracle for the MPs to mistake him for an army officer. Linda Ventimiglia, an army reserve officer, would not be a problem. She and Bourgeois, a former Navy lieutenant, had given Rosebaugh a crash course on military decorum and worked on his salute. The three had also practiced scaling trees in an Alabama pine forest, and Bourgeois finally decided they were ready, as they were going to be. He went over the details of their plan one last time, and then double-checked the supplies: pepper, a rope ladder, tree climbers, a high-powered Sony cassette player with four speakers, and most important, the tape recording. As night fell, the three set out, dressed as high-ranking officers with insignia also purchased at the Army surplus store. They loaded their equipment in the Land Rover of a friend who had agreed to drive them to the base. Bourgeois braced himself as they neared the entrance. The Land Rover had a Fort Benning sticker, but an MP at the checkpoint seemed to eye them suspiciously. Then, to their amazement, he snapped a salute. Theirs were a little shaky. The driver eased onto the base, passing several warning signs that said they were entering a restricted zone and unauthorized persons would be prosecuted. The vehicle stopped near a tank trail in the wood. There, the three quickly gathered their equipment and began walking down the trail that led to the quarters of several hundred Salvadoran soldiers. Soon, the lights of the barracks became visible, and the three edged closer, looking for a suitable tree. After they agreed on a towering 100-foot pine, Rosebaugh sprinkled pepper on the ground to prevent guard dogs from picking up their scent. Bourgeois, meanwhile, strapped the tree climbers to his boots and began scaling the pine. After he secured his footing, he dropped the rope ladder for Ventimiglia and Rosebaugh. As he did, he broke a branch. Instantly, German shepherds began barking at a nearby MP station. Ventimiglia and Rosebaugh slowly climbed up and then tossed the rope ladder to the ground. Bourgeois anchored the tape player high in the tree, aiming at the barracks. Then there was a collective sigh of relief. They had gotten into the belly of the beast. Bourgeois, a Marinal priest, silently prayed that no one would get shot and reminded himself of the reasons they were taking such risks. It was not complicated. The U.S. military was training a brutal foreign army on U.S. soil, an army that served a small Salvadoran elite who lived in splendor while the poor lived in squalor, an army that had butchered thousands of innocent people, including women and children, priests and nuns, an army that had raped and murdered two of his friends. The weight in the trees felt interminable. The three kept shifting their weight to get comfortable. Suddenly, the barracks lights went out. Finally, the moment had come. The three steeled themselves as Bourgeois reached up and pressed the play button on the tape player, saying, "Oscar, this is for you." Moments later, the voice of the dead Salvadoran Archbishop Oscar Romero boomed in Spanish from the treetops, shattering the silence below.
"I would like to make a special appeal to the members of the Army, and specifically to the ranks of the National Guard, the police, and the military. Brothers, each one of you is one of us. We are the same people. The peasants you kill are your own brothers and sisters. When you hear the voice of a man commanding you to kill, remember the voice of God, thou shalt not kill."
It was the Archbishop's last Sunday homily, delivered in the San Salvador Cathedral on March 23, 1980. His fateful words had stung the Salvadoran military and led to his assassination the next day. Romero's words again triggered a violent reaction as they echoed through the barracks at Fort Benning, imploring the startled Salvadorans to disobey orders to kill. It was as if someone had poked a beehive. The base was abuzz. Lights beamed. Sirens wailed. MPs with M16s swarmed over the grounds, but in the darkness they had trouble locating the source of the disturbance, even with the aid of the dogs. It was a sacred moment, Bourgeois later recalled. Those soldiers coming out of the barracks, looking into the sky, not being able to see us, hearing the words of this prophet. Finally, one of the lights fixed on the rope ladder at the base of the pine and then illuminated the trespassers up the tree. The MPs started cursing and threatening to shoot them down, but even with weapons trained on him, Bourgeois stalled for time, hoping to play the entire homily. He shouted down that they no longer had the rope ladder as the MPs scurried about, trying to figure out what to do. The tape played over and over.
"No soldier is obliged to obey an order contrary to the law of God. There is still time for you to obey your own conscience, even in the face of a sinful command to kill. In the name of God, in the name of our tormented people whose cries rise up to heaven, I beseech you, I beg you, I command you, stop the repression."
As the chaos on the ground grew, the dogs started to fight among themselves. A couple MPs tried to pull them apart, while another started to climb the pine, grabbing branches of nearby trees to pull himself up. Then another went up with the rope ladder. Rosebaugh, whose perch was lowest in the tree, was taken down first, then Ventimiglia. Rosebaugh was strip-searched, and Ventimiglia was gagged. Meanwhile, the first MP had climbed nearly 60 feet up to get Bourgeois and shut off the cassette. After Romero's voice was silenced, Bourgeois started shouting the bishop's words in Spanish, angering the MPs on the ground. When he finally descended the tree, a trainer was waiting for him. "He hit me from behind," Bourgeois said later, "then threw me up against the tree and stripped me." There were five or six agitated dogs and about 10 MPs with M16s who were shining lights on us. The trainer got in his karate pose and wanted me to get up and fight, but his own men pulled him off. The tree climbing had shown a light on the U.S. Army's infamous School of the Americas. And as Bourgeois would learn later, years later, the school had in fact trained the Salvadoran officers who murdered the U.S. churchwoman and ordered the assassination of Archbishop Romero. This has been your actual American History Channel, an excerpt from the book Disturbing the Peace, sponsored by Powder Milk Democrat Gonads. Heavens, they're pasty. Now please join us as we look in on the new CBS reality TV show, One Day in the Life of an American Solzhenitsyn, an American Mandela, an American Thomas Jefferson, an American prisoner. An American prisoner recently looked out from his prison window, a high prison window, in the middle of a big city, down on the little people and little cars below. Behind him, on his coarse blanket on his bed, various newspapers and magazines were strewn about because he was allowed to have information coming in, just none going out. The dates on the papers and magazines were behind the times, but they did get there eventually. He was not allowed pencil or paper, but he was allowed to think. And as he did every day, he thought out the letter that he would send to everyone when he someday got that chance. He was for some reason sure that what he had to say would be news to those below, which it surely would be. I look out my window at kids on a playground with their mothers. Would these children know they live in a fascist society? Would their parents know they live in a fascist society? Is it possible to live in a fascist society without realizing it? Of course it's possible. When you talk about fascism, people instinctively talk about Hitler and Mussolini and brown shirts and walking goose step down the streets. That's fascism that's in your face. Of course, it doesn't have to be like that. That's not the defining feature. Fascism can be sexy. Fascism can look like American Idol or Monday Night Football, internet video games or whatever. It can be the things that distract you, the citizen, from what's actually going on. Fascism, in other words, can be a lot more attractive than they realize to people. What we have is invisible fascism. It's fascism that people can't really see. Frankly, because most people don't have the conceptual tools to understand what's happened. Most people have to work. They've got families. They've got things to do. They're not out there to fight the machine. They're not out there to be heroes. They just want to live their lives. They don't want to have trouble. They haven't really studied this matter. They may feel in their bones that there's something wrong. Sure they do. But it's one thing to feel there's something wrong, and it's another to be able to put it all together and to conceptualize it and to see how it's wrong. So I see what has happened is that it's a fascism that you can feel, but you can't see it because you don't know how to see it. That's why I call it invisible. 9/11 plays a crucial part in allowing that, because what was necessary was to have a legal revolution within the United States. And that, of course, is what 9/11 has allowed. It has allowed a fascist revolution. What else do we call it? It has gone under the radar as such. It seems Obama is another of the neocons, same as Bush, maybe same as them all, who believe in some guy called Leo Strauss more than the founding fathers. It's not what we are taught in sixth grade civics. It's not what we think of as America. But when we take a look at what is happening around us, outside our windows, up and down the freeway, as we cruise along texting to each other about somebody said something about Susan somewhere, that might be what we have. We look out our window and ask, where is King? Where is Kennedy? Where is Wellstone? And of course we know. There is only us.
The American prisoner turned from the window as he heard a familiar clatter in the hallway. The guard stuck his meal tray through the slot, and the prisoner exchanged greetings with the guard, took his tray to sit on this bed to eat. Join us next week on One Day in the Life of an American Solzhenitsyn, an American Mandela, an American Thomas Jefferson, when we will see the American prisoner thinking about drones and dead children, rich people and poor people, who really are the terrorists and who really are the freedom fighters, and stuff like that.
Our second guest of the evening is Jim Fetzer. Jim Fetzer is a retired professor, an American researcher. He is the preeminent, along with Kevin Barrett, the preeminent American researcher into conspiracy theories and false flag, giving us the real news each week on No Lies Radio, False Flag Weekly News. And Jim comes to us each second week of each month from Madison, Wisconsin. And Chuck will be getting Jim's...
Mike and Chuck, it's great to be back on with you guys again. I've been following the trial in Boston of Zohar Sarnoff, who was accused of involvement in the Boston bombing, but was in fact merely a patsy. But where his attorney, Judy Clark, who's rather well known, has pled him innocent, but in her opening statement declared he did it, which is completely outrageous since all of the evidence is against it. The trial has been an absurdity involving the suppression of evidence, lies, and distortions by both the prosecution and the defense, which turns out to be a violation of the canons of ethics for attorneys. So I have published an article about it entitled "The Boston Show Trial Attorney Declares Patsy Guilty," where in her opening statement she said he did it. And now as the trial has continued, we have even more absurdities, including a bloody confession Zohar is alleged to have written on the inside of the boat where he was apprehended, which I'm publishing today under the title "The Boston Show Trial, The Bloody Confession of Zohar Sarnoff." Let me explain. According to the Associated Press, jurors see bloody confession Zohar Sarnoff etched on boat 10 March 2015. The accused Boston bomber used to write out an explanation for his actions on the inside of a boat in the dark. This exemplifies the absurdity of the phony trial taking place in Boston to cover up the phony bombing. The confession is written in straight lines which are uniformly spaced, which would be impossible for someone lying on their side and using the curved surface of a boat as their template. I include here a video of his capture from the boat. Etching, by the way, involves a process of using acid to cut into a metal surface to create a design in relief. It cannot be done on a wooden surface with a pencil. And who in their right mind would think that a young man in fear of his life would take a pencil and compose such a thoughtful and detailed explanation of his exploits with his brother? Think about it. We are supposed to believe at least the following half dozen propositions which account for his acts with a series of sentences that are not merely improbable, but simply impossible, especially from the point of view of three-dimensional geometry. A, he was in a state of agitation being tracked by police. B, he was inside a boat which has curved surfaces. C, he was using a pencil and writing in the dark. D, he calmly wrote out an elaborate confession. E, which consisted of smooth, straight lines. F, which were likewise uniformly spaced. And someone had the presence of mind to climb back into that boat and study its surfaces to discover this manuscript, which was etched inside the boat after the target of a massive police hunt, which had invoked the use of military force to perform police functions in violation of the Potosi Comitatus Statute of 1878, which precludes the use of the military to perform police function, and the lockdown of a major American city in the pursuit of a single 19-year-old college student who provably had nothing to do with the fake bombing. The absurdity of the situation is palpable. Not even Leonardo could have done it. Among his many talents, the magnificent Leonardo da Vinci was noted for writing backwards, where what he had written could only be read using a mirror. Here's a sample of Leonardo's writing with a confession that the authorities allege was found inside of a boat where Docar purportedly had used a pencil to etch it. And here I show the handwriting. Leonardo's, bear in mind, Leonardo was writing on a hard, flat surface, while Docar was purportedly writing on the curved surface of the inside of a boat, lying down and writing with a pencil. This is about as absurd as it gets, because while Leonardo's handwriting is equally uniform and evenly spaced, he was writing on a flat surface, and it would have been impossible for Zocar to have produced a script that has been adduced on the three-dimensional geometric surface of the boat. It doesn't require the intelligence of Sherlock Holmes to realize that this has to be a Photoshopped image or a two-dimensional simulation of his writing on a flat surface was projected onto a photograph of the inside of the boat to create the impression of having been written on the three-dimensional surface of a curved boat. They had to fake it because they could only create the impression of guilt by faking it. Here's a summary of the situation we're in from Truth and News, a homespun community-oriented television show produced in Seattle. There is much more, of course, which can be found in the article Boston Show Trial, Attorney Declares Patsy Guilty, which I have previously published at Veterans Today. And in that article, I embed an update of the evidence. Proof that Zocar didn't do it. Even though Zocar's attorney, Judy Clark, has pled him innocent, her opening assertion that he did it obviated that defense and facilitated the state in convicting him of a crime that he did not commit by conceding his guilt. I have previously observed that she thereby violated the rules of conduct for the Massachusetts Bar, which I have contacted to complain that Clark has violated Mass Bar Rule 8.4C, for engaging in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation, and 8.4D for behavior that is prejudicial to the administration of justice. The video to which I refer, which is entitled The Real Deal Special, Must See Boston Bombing Update, of course, demonstrates that this was a drill where no one was killed, and the actual perps who placed the bombs were Kraft International personnel. We have police on bullhorns calling out, "This is a drill! This is a drill!" We have tweets from the Boston Globe that state a controlled demolition will be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities. And another that asserts it will be set off opposite the library in 1 minute, and 1 minute later, it explodes. We have the complete absence of blood after the explosion, which has Lorraine Day, MD, who was chief of orthopedic surgery at San Francisco General Hospital for 25 years, has explained would be impossible had these been real victims of a real bombing. And Nathan Foulkes, a Hollywood producer-director, has identified one of the key players as an actor he had cast in one of his own films, and that what was going on is known as hyper-realistic filming, where scenes are created to look as realistic as possible. Typically, this would be for the benefit of, say, inexperienced troops to give them a sense of what they might encounter in combat, and where, as the video displays, we even have the images of Steven Spielberg, who was present at the time, where this appears to have been a Steven Spielberg production, even though it was not announced as one, which I have confirmed with Nathan Foulkes, who has acknowledged that Hollywood is aware of his involvement and rather appalled. I also discuss a profile of Judy Clark, who has her offices in San Diego, California, where I served 2 years at the recruit depot supervising recruit training. This is simply appalling. As a member of the California Bar, she has also violated its statutes, including Rule 5200, trial conduct, in presenting a matter to a tribunal. A member, A, shall employ, for the purpose of maintaining the causes confided to the member, such means only as are consistent with truth, and Rule 5200B shall not seek to mislead the judge, judicial officer, or jury by an artifice or false statement of fact or law, and Rule 5220, suppression of evidence. A member shall not suppress any evidence that the member or that member's client has a legal obligation to reveal or produce. And she has to know that this is the case, because after a show I did with Stu Webb in which we discussed her malfeasance, I released her phone number of her office, and dozens of persons, including myself, have to have called her office, just as I did, to volunteer that Nathan Foulkes and I would be glad to serve as expert witnesses, and where Lorraine Day, MD, would be an extra addition. Her conduct is simply despicable. She must be held to account. The American people are being lied to. The judicial process is a sham. We must set this right. Mike, Chuck, thanks. Everyone needs to know.
Thank you, Jim, for an incisive commentary on the Boston bombing trial. Coming up next hour, it's The Empire, Stupid, with Phil Ferrugio, a 5-minute segment that just keeps getting better every week from our weekly columnist, Phil Ferrugio. Also, in the next hour, we'll be having Susan Lindauer, who's a whistleblower with the CIA. Mike, what else do we have coming up?
We have our review of today's news, Chuck.
Well, thanks.
You and I have our news show.
All right, okay. I forgot.
We'll
thank
see you.
You.
There. Yep. Chuck, are you there? Well, you seem to be having some technical difficulties. We're trying to get Phil Ferrugio online. Chuck, can you hear me? Hello, Chuck. Can you hear me now? Hello, Chuck.
I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. Hello, everyone. Now for your local Earth news. This is Chuck Gregory and Mike Palachuk with a review of today's news from the eye of the hurricane and the eye of the blizzard. On March 4, 2015, former Florida State Trooper and school safety expert Wolfgang Halbig appeared on the Alex Jones Show to announce a lawsuit he's filed in Florida seeking information from officials across the United States involved in the December 14, 2012 Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre event. The new bombshell info, Halbig states, is that the subpoenas have been issued across the country. We're about to get discovery information that is now forthcoming, If they don't provide that discovery information, they're going to be in contempt of court. We also have the Connecticut Freedom of Information Commission hearing that is supposed to have already happened. They keep dragging and dragging, but eventually we are going to get to the truth. The truth is going to show that Sandy Hook, that school was not an operating school. And I can tell you that from being a school administrator. Hal Big is convinced that Sandy Hook Elementary School was not functioning in 2012 because Newtown officials are incapable of producing routine paperwork that would verify its operation at that time. I know it's not operating because the school board is refusing to answer all of the questions we've asked in the Connecticut Freedom of Information request, Halbig told Jones in the interview. Wolfgang Halbig's website is sandyhookjustice.com. Why does the FBI have to manufacture its own plots if terrorism and ISIS are such grave threats? The FBI and major media outlets yesterday trumpeted the agency's latest counterterrorism triumph, the arrest of three Brooklyn men ages 19 to 30 on charges of conspiring to travel to Syria to fight for ISIS. It appears that none of the three men was in any condition to travel or support the Islamic State without help from the FBI informant. One of the frightening terrorist villains told the FBI informant that beyond having no money, he had encountered a significant problem in following through on the FBI's plot. His mom had taken away his passport. In this regard, this latest arrest appears to be quite similar to the overwhelming majority of terrorism arrests the FBI has proudly touted over the last decade. As the FBI manipulated a 20-year-old loner who lived with his parents into allegedly agreeing to join an FBI-created plot to attack the Capitol, these cases follow a very clear pattern. The known facts from this latest case seem to fit well within a now-familiar FBI pattern, whereby the agency does not disrupt planned domestic terror attacks, but rather creates them. Then publicly praises itself for stopping its own plots. First, they target a Muslim, not due to any evidence of intent or capability to engage in terrorism, but rather for the radical political views he expresses. In most cases, the Muslim targeted by the FBI is a very young, late teens, early 20s, adrift, unemployed loner, who's shown no signs of mastering basic life functions, let alone carrying out a serious terror attack, and has no known involvement with actual terrorist groups. They then find another Muslim who's highly motivated to help disrupt a terror plot, either because they're being paid substantial sums of money by the FBI, or because they're charged with some unrelated crime and are desperate to please the FBI in exchange for leniency, or both. The FBI then gives the informant a detailed attack plan and sometimes even the money and other instruments to carry it out. And the informant then shares all of that with his target, typically. The informant also induces, lures, cajoles, and persuades the target to agree to carry out the FBI design plot. In some instances where the target refuses to go along, they have their informant offer huge cash inducements to the impoverished target. Once they finally get the target to agree, the FBI swoops in at the last minute, arrests the target, issues a press release praising themselves for disrupting a dangerous attack. And the DOJ and federal judges send their target to prison for years or even decades. Once again, we should all pause for a moment to thank the brave men and women of the FBI for saving us from their own terror plots. That's all, folks. That's the news, and we're out of here. Good night and good luck, and so it goes. That's the way it is. Stay on the same page. Take it to the next level. At the end of the day, it is what it is. Have a good day. bring something to the table and never make direct eye contact with a policeman. Our third guest, Susan Lindauer, is coming up, and I'm going to try to call her right now.
Hello there, everybody.
Well, hello, Susan. Welcome to the show, and take it away.
Thank you very much. Everybody, it's great to be on with you. This is an exciting time that we're facing. I don't think that we should be so afraid as we have been. I have been, now I'm speaking about fear in my own right. I shouldn't try to project that onto other people. It is, my perceptions are altered and impacted by what I suffered from the feds 11 years ago, almost to this very day, March 11th, 2004, I was arrested on the Patriot Act. But I'm starting to feel like there's hope. And I've gone through periods of intense despair is not the right word, but and disillusionment is not the right word, because I'm more convinced than ever that we have there's really stupid people running our government, and I'm really baffled by what the heck they think they're doing. But I'm more and more convinced that we, our side, has really good, smart people with some really good ideas. And I think that a lot of people, and I'm preaching to the choir here, I know that you guys are the ones with the smart ideas, right? Okay, so, but our side really, I think, can contribute in ways that the corporate elite, the corporatists, have been resistant for so long, they've kept us out for so long, and yet they really have run up against their own, they know that they don't have any ideas, and they're desperately scrounging to get something, and I think they're finally ready to hear us, and I think they are hearing us at some levels. For example, the 28 pages of the redacted 9/11 report by the House and Senate, finally, we've got members of Congress who are pushing to get this out to the people and pushing to expose Saudi financial connections to Al-Qaeda. This is a sea change, people. The other thing that really has blown me away is that Lord Rothschild, you know, of the Rothschild banking horror, you know, that has destroyed all of us. Don't worry, I'm not about to say anything nice about him. But check this out. He has warned that investors are facing, quote, the most dangerous geopolitical situation since World War II on account of income inequality. Finally, the crazy people, the crazy corporatists, the Bilderbergs, are starting to see that their policies are wrecking our economies and they're wrecking our middle class. And maybe, just maybe, these fools, and I'm not defending, you're not going to ever hear a nice word about the Rothschilds and from me, ever. Or the Zionists of Israel. Never, never, never. But they're starting to see that maybe they need us. And in this case, you know, what he's advocating, of course, because he's a crazy man, he's a psychopath, is that he's advocating, that he's saying that, oh, woe is us, our rich friends are all buying farms in New Zealand and the Caribbean, and we're all rushing off to, you know, we've all got to have private airstrips for our Learjets to land, so that when the masses, when the huddled, the poor, tired, huddled masses can't take it anymore, they explode on the streets, we're all going to have to run away and hide, because what will happen to us when they're going to tear us to pieces? the former middle class is going to tear us to pieces on account of this income inequality. And in the middle of all of this, steps a really great woman who I want all of you to check out. Her name is Daniela Walls, and she has formed something called the Tax Wall Street Party. And you can find them at the taxwallstreetparty.org. And they are putting candidates in the 2016 elections in 25 states. Now you say, oh yeah, they're like the Libertarians, they're like the Green Party, they're third party. But what she is doing, they are not socially conservative or socially liberal. They have an economic policy, and they're pushing it, hoping that the main parties, both sides, either side, will embrace these basic values. And check out what this is. The Tax Wall Street Party favors, one, a 1% Wall Street sales tax, like an interaction tax, like every time, a transaction tax. It's a 1% transaction tax, okay, for every Wall Street trader who deals above $1 million a year. So it's not a tax that you or I would pay if we ever had, you know, an extra $500, ha, ha, ha. Not on my budget, baby, not on my budget. If we had an extra $500 to invest in a Wall Street stock, we would not pay a 1% transaction tax. This is only on the Wall Street traders on their cumulative trades for the whole year. If they have above 1 million in Wall Street trades, then they pay this tax for everything. Well, let me put this into context for you. The state of New York government in Albany has a 0.34% tax that targets Wall Street. And they generate from this 0.34% tax generates $20 billion a year for infrastructure. That they use for infrastructure. And the Lord knows it's not enough money because New York is falling to pieces. But they are generating cash from this. And if we had a 1% federal tax, the Tax Wall Street Party would give half of it to the state and half of it to the feds. And it would be a 1% tax. In, you know, like there are Wall Street traders in Los Angeles, in California, in New Mexico, in Illinois, in Nebraska. There are Wall Street traders everywhere. And again, only those earning above $1 million would pay a transaction tax for their cumulative sales. But they have estimated, this Wall Street Party has estimated that we could raise $2 trillion to $3 trillion a year, people, from this tiny little tax on these, you know, and right now they have, right now there's nothing. You know, if you or I go to the grocery store and we buy a loaf of bread, we pay a tax on that. If we go buy to dinner, if we go buy some furniture, if we go buy anything, if we purchase anything, if we engage in any, if we buy a book on Amazon, you know, we pay a sales tax of like 8%. And we're talking about a 1% transaction tax. This is so small. We're all sick of hearing that Wall Street can't pay any taxes because it won't be fair. It'll be mean. It'll hurt their feelings. To hell with that. We have some serious problems, people, and we had darn well better figure out how to solve them right now. This is a viable solution. The other thing that would actually generate money for us, for our states and for federal revenues, it would be hitting the wealthiest Americans, no one else. And hello?
Yes.
Okay, good. No. I started to wonder if I had dropped off. Okay, good. Sorry. Okay. And the second thing that she wants to do is nationalize the Federal Reserve, which I think is another brilliant idea. You know, the Federal Reserve should stop being a private bank. So here, you know, here we are. And so this is what I want to say to you guys this month on my show, my portion of the show. We're in really bad trouble. We are. We're in a bind. We're in a terrible, terrible, terrible mess. But we have the solutions among us, and our creativity and our innovation and our activism. We are the ones who are going to find the solutions, and we are finding the solutions. And finally, the bad guys, the stupid people, the idiots, may be so over. They may finally be ready to hear us.
Well, thank you so much for being with us, Susan. I'm especially fascinated by that 1% transaction tax idea. Thank you for bringing it to us, and we'll talk to you next month.
Okay, thank you very much.
Join us now as we join in progress the next episode of Nebraska Inc., Amelia Earhart, tattoo artist of the Heartland. The locals know her as Babs. Her shop is on Main Street between the barber shop and the cafe, with a picture of a floundering big plane atop the front door. She got off course, or she's hiding out, waiting for her chance to do what she was asked to do so long ago by FDR.
Or maybe there was no spy mission for FDR, just a desire to fly around the world. She doesn't seem to care anymore. She just wants to be free to live out her days in Nebraska doing what she loves, talking about the Cornhuskers and making tattoos. Navigator Fred Noonan runs the front desk at the little tattoo shop. He's got his shirt all up, his feet up on the desk, his tongue sticking out, working on a full stomach tattoo of the Marshall Islands. Hey, Fred! Amelia shouts from the back room. He knows what she's going to say, so he revs the motor high. Amelia's going to ask again what they were doing out in the Pacific and what FDR asked them to do. Hey, Fred! And then she's going to ask how they crashed and how they survived and how they got back. Fred! And was it all a dream? And what they're doing in Nebraska? Amelia has a bobblehead alien doll named Roswell on her desk. She's got a black Bilderberg birthday balloon stuck to the ceiling signed by Prescott Bush. There's black and white photos of the JFK, RFK, and MLK shootings on her wall, all from angles and vantages that have never appeared elsewhere. On her desk is a stack of letters from the passengers from the planes of September 11, 2001 that she hasn't had time to answer. And one from Timothy McVeigh, postmarked with a tropical stamp. There's a CD in the machine. The director's cut of the Sandy Hook shooting. She watched it last night and stayed up too late. Now she's paying for it. Her niece is visiting for a few days this summer, Amelia Rose Earhart. She just completed a flight around the world that covered Auntie Amelia's same flight, ending in Nebraska. The niece wants to just hang out and maybe learn the art of tattooing and get a Cornhuskers jersey and eat corn with her bare hands while sitting on the railroad tracks and running her bare toes through the hard red rocks. And she says she's waiting for someone. Amelia walks up front, tells Fred she's going to the store for cigarettes, and all the while, she's just staring up at the sky, tripping a few times, then bending down to pluck a yellow tulip from somebody's prim front yard garden, sticking it behind her ear. Where are you? She whispers, with wide, wet eyes just before she bumps into the produce manager from Too Much Food, bending her tulip. He gives her a black tulip as she hands him the yellow tulip, without quite knowing why. She goes in to open her mailbox with her key and pulls out a manila envelope marked with a 1937 stamp, postmarked Manila, and forwarded to the Bangkok Bar in East Minneapolis and then on to Nebraska. There's someone else in the post office pulling something out of his box. Amelia asks the young man, "What'd you get?" He turns to her and says, "I didn't get nothing. I had to pay $50 and pick up the garbage." She runs her long purple fingernail under the flap, cuts herself, licks her finger and swallows the blood. Pulls out a black and white 8x10 glossy photograph of she and Fred standing on the beach on some island. Their arms around the shoulders of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Joe DiMaggio, Al Capp, and Al Capone. And now, that photograph, copies of that photograph, have turned up in the teacher's lounge of St. Regis Jesuit High School in Denver, as well as the condiment table of the State Roads Department Paint Crew Coffee Corner on Harney Street in Omaha, Nebraska, and in the dining car of the Amtrak California Zephyr at midnight, into that dark dining car screeching through Del Mar, empty but for the tired cook smoking at the bar, comes a tall man in a tweed suit wearing a Stetson with a Miami Dolphins sticker, steel-toed boots marked Made in Havana, and carrying a briefcase handcuffed to his arm. He sits down in the back booth, stares out the window, opens the briefcase with a key he draws so slowly out of his nose. He lays the briefcase flat on the table, reverently draws out the 8x10 black and white glossy photograph of Amelia Earhart, Fred Noonan, Joe DiMaggio, Al Capone, Al Capp, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt dining in a window booth at Alice's restaurant. The thin man in the Stetson autographs the photograph with a purple magic marker, leaves the purple magic marker resting on the 8x10 glossy photograph, tips his cap to the smoking cook and exits the dining car. The tired cook smoking at the bar slumps over, picks up the 8x10 glossy photograph as the purple magic marker rolls to the floor. He opens a window, slides the photograph out, and it is caught by the wind and then by a biker sitting by the tracks in the woods on his black 1946 Indian Chief cycle. The passenger on the bike wears a black leather jacket with Oswald stitched on the back. They take off into the woods, 1/2 mile exactly, hand the 8x10 glossy photograph to a 10 3/4 foot jet black Bigfoot named Bubba Brad, just as a craft hovering above the valley turns on its landing lights. Alan, the alien, the driver of the craft marked Malaysian 370, shines the light on Bubba Brad, and the 10 3/4 foot Bigfoot glides up the beam of light as if on an escalator. As he enters the shuttle bus, he hands the 8x10 glossy photograph to a man wearing a plastic sheriff's badge that says secret agent. The man is from East Grand Forks. He is, of course, Zach Black, an extra in the movie The French Connection, who's done other things since then. Bubba Brad, the Bigfoot, whispers to Zach Black, "Beware the Ebola bunny," which causes Zach Black to wonder about the overall sincerity of Bubba Brad, the Bigfoot, but he has a job to do, and so Zach Black puts the glossy photograph under a Class 51 flashy thing electron microscope and sees the markings embedded in the photo that say Ukraine, Israel, Syria, Gaza, Libya, Egypt, Iran, ISIS, ISIL, buried at sea, Jessica Lynch, Pat Tillman, torture photos at Guantanamo, and Black Ops rendition cruises in a 61 gray Studebaker from the A&W on North Street in East Dubuque to the Moose Lodge in Davenport. He sees something more in the embedded microchip thing photo parts, something about Amelia's niece, something about her not being who she says she is, something about her being a former cheerleader for the Iowa Hawkeyes, and oh my, can this be? He can also see that she has a tattoo on the small of her back, a monarch butterfly, a honeybee, and a decapitated Hawkeye mascot with a Cheshire cat smile. And below that it says in ancient Mayan script, MH17, David Shaler, Charlie Sheen, CIA, Obama, Wile E. Coyote, beep beep, and a number, 8675309. And Black looks up and asks, though nobody's in the room, waiting for whom? This Amelia Rose, the niece. Waiting for whom? And the thought comes into Black's head from somewhere, somehow. To every man his little cross till he dies and it's forgotten. And then the thought is gone. And he returns to his task. This niece here, waiting for who? I've been waiting for, I don't know. Black hears a voice in the dark room. He turns around and says, "Who's there?" Nobody answers. He says louder, "Who is there?" Silence. Black gets a piercing pain in his temple and an image is projected into his brain. And it is the Ebola bunny, and then a deep foreigner voice. "Stay thirsty, my friends." And then the Ebola bunny turns into the face of Bill Hicks, and Zach Black hears Hicks speak. "I was over in Australia. They celebrate Easter the exact same way we do, commemorating the death and resurrection of Jesus, by telling our children a giant bunny rabbit left chocolate eggs in the night. Now I wonder why we're ripped up as a race. Anybody got any idea? You know, I've read the Bible. I can't find the word bunny or chocolate anywhere in the fucking book. Where do they come up with this stuff? Why not goldfish left Lincoln logs in your sock drawer? As long as you're making crap up, you know, go hog wild. At least a goldfish with a Lincoln log on its back going across your carpet has some miraculous connotations. Mommy, I woke up today and there was a Lincoln log in me sock drawer. That's the story of Jesus." And then more silence. And then a door squeaking open, squeaking closed, as something rolls slowly, unevenly, as a lopsided bowling ball across the floor of the darkened room. It bumps against Black's shoe. He leans down, squats, looks close. Black gasps loudly, stands quickly to get away from the head of Officer Obie. And somewhere, a radio plays. The door of a red VW microbus is open. The engine is smoking, but running. The red VW microbus is smacked into a tree. Blood everywhere. Implements of destruction scattered everywhere. Inside bodies. Above and around the red VW microbus. And all those inside the red VW microbus, Timothy McVeigh, Barbara Olson, George W. Bush, Crystal Campbell, Paul McCartney, Buddy Holly, George H.W. Bush, Mrs. Calabash, Barbara Bush, John Stewart, Rachel Maddow, Todd Beamer, Nancy Lanza, Jack Ruby, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Colin Powell, Karl Rove, Condoleezza Rice, Bart Simpson, the Coen Brothers, Stanley Kubrick, Walt Disney, John Dulles, Buzz Aldrin, Tom Hanks are dead. All dead. Secret Agent Zach Black strains, stands still with the head of Officer Obie still touching his toe. He strains all the limits and boundaries of credulity to hear the radio in the red VW microbus. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant.
Mystery, deceit, tattoos, tattered tulips, manila envelopes, Quebec red, Harney Street, purple magic markers in Del Mar, landing lights, East Grand Forks, ISIS, ISIL, A&W, Hawkeyes, Beep Beep, Fred and Amelia, the Ebola Bunny, Father Rapers. It's all there waiting for you in the next episode of Nebraska Inc. Amelia Earhart, tattoo artist of the Heartland. Well, it's been another long week in Duluth, Minnesota, my hometown at the end of the empire. Duluth is big burritos, an apricot wheat beer, and a parade to celebrate cold weather. Duluth can be murder. It's the big lake, big woods, big tradition, big old buildings, like an old sailor headed back to his boat at 4 a.m, stumbling, never falling. It's the sauna and the secrets of the North Woods. It's schools on top of bars, on top of bait shops. And it's adventure, and it's being able to be yourself. But Duluth can be murder. It's the trains, the taconite, guns, tattoos, bowling, brawls, Bigfoot, and ball games. It's laser tag. It's the bomb. It's the bowl. It's the gold. We continue our story, fast-forwarding past the recent news of a surfer on Lake Superior having somehow disappeared, as we meet the ship captain, Jimmy, fireman, hunter, the Indian chief, the businessman, Air Force captain, prison guard, as they meet for their daily ritual, solving the world's problems, sitting naked on a solid oak bench, sweating their asses off.
Well, it was Winnie Bloodfeather helped him do it, paid him to do it, is how I heard it. The ship captain pushed off to check the thermometer on the wall. He got in close to see, and through the fog on the glass and the sweat in his eyes, he saw the mercury line. 120, he said, as he sat his bare bottom on the top wood bench. Pour some water on it. Get it going in here. It's hot in here. It's a sauna. Jimmy sat high up in the corner, his knees pulled to his chest, his eyes closed, his head back against the cedar slat wall. He listened, never talked with the naked men all around him on the two rows around the rocks in the sauna, dragging their penises and scrotums across the smooth, fine wood to find their special spot. So the fireman opened. Everyone kind of leaned that way. The fireman studied his toes and his eyes drooped. I guess somebody's sneaking bait into the prison, the businessman decided to chirp up. Everyone does it. You can get bait anywhere in there, I guess they say. The prison guard opened his mouth just as the fireman remembered what it was. Did you hear about? Well, sure you did. That guy used to sit out on the card table on the mall, right in the middle of the road where everybody got to go around him. It's by McDonald's. I don't know if it's a McDonald's table or what. It's not yellow, just a table, a card table, you know. You know, like they have at funerals and such. He sat with Winnie Bloodfeather. Some others, he came back from Afghanistan all crazy. He sits out there every day, having coffee all day, wearing his uniform and hat and boots, and has his gun. I don't know if it's loaded or what. Sitting right there on that goddamn table. Well, he's the one shot the mayor. And everyone kind of leaned back into their spot, even their buttocks on the smooth wood, and let the pain go out of their butt bones where they were leaning to show respect for the fireman's story. Somebody nodded. Somebody said, yeah. They all knew already, of course. It had been in the newspapers, on the radio, on the TV, that the returning war hero Robert Lund, the first Duluth resident from West Duluth, Denfeld, first one to win a bronze medal, or, well, some color. Well, he's the one that killed the mayor, and he's in the jail, not the regular county jail, but a special jail they must have in the basement of City Hall or something for special cases. That's what somebody said. Someone says all that, and everyone already knows it, and they nod, some of them, and they rest their weight on their hands on both sides of their legs and sit with their heads going straight down like buzzards. Up there in that corner, Jimmy got the biggest blast of steam when they poured water on the rocks. Sometimes he had to put his hands over his ears to keep them from burning and cup a hand around his mouth so the air he sucked down did not torch his lungs. The hunter started in about Winnie Bloodfeather, who was the assistant deputy mayor or something before Mary Pine was murdered, and now she's interim mayor or something, and until they can hold a special election or something. Or maybe old Pike comes back, says the retired Air Force guy with the gigantic mole on his shoulder that no one ever mentions. Well, you know she's in on it, said the prison guard with his eyes closed and the permanent water droplet perched on the end of his nose. Jimmy imagined the moles they must look with their clothes on, not the tired out saggy old bodies with the sweat droplets covering them like frost on a tree. The ship captain in his white captain's cap with the gold emblems half stood to look around for the special cup. Someone stole the Jesus damn mug again, he said, as his behind rotated in keeping with the tiny movements of his feet, like a circus elephant in ring number one. And his head down, his eyes searching the same spots over and over as he twirled. Now everyone started to move and look down and behind them, even Jimmy. They patted their legs like they had to show they did not have a cup in their pockets. Slapped hands on the smooth wood and scoured their areas like they were sanding a new deck. Here you go. The hunter, wearing just blaze orange socks pulled to his knees, held up the special brown mug. Frosty pine, said the Indian chief, his hair falling all around his shoulders, his stomach and breast heaving and flapping as he breathed. I heard she ran to Venezuela, something like that. It was a handmade cup with some kind of special markings made especially for Asana by Finns or by Indians or by a potter at the university or someone bought it in the gift shop at Fitker's or Target. It held a good bit of water. There was a Wands truck parked in the DECC last night, 2-3 nights ago, said the businessman. All by itself, just this one Wands truck. The businessman, wearing just a red necktie, was sitting by the spigot. So he took the mug and filled it, then got up, and before he poured it on the rocks, the World War II veteran with medals pinned into his chest held out a glass vial. Here, he said. The businessman knew just what to do. He poured the special sauce into the water and dashed the water on the rocks. Steam hissed up and everyone went silent as the guilty bowing their heads and sucking down the last bit of usable air. The eucalyptus smell filled the capsule like innocent invisible gas. Nothing could taste so sweet, smuggled essence. Glass vials were verboten, danger of breaking and cutting feet to ribbons. They're swinging meat in those trucks, someone said. Jimmy didn't recognize the voice, and he didn't care. He rested his head on the wall and let his eyes close, saving the moment, the heat, the smell, the memory. It's an ice cream truck, said someone new. Swinging meat. Human meat. You do not want to go there, bro, said the prison guard. Juan's from Mexico. Juan's from Mexico.
And that's the news from Duluth, where all the police and soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats and journalists are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO lone gunmen are about average.
And that just about wraps another episode of the New American Dream Radio Show. We thank you for joining us tonight. We hope you'll be back next week and every week. Thank you and good night, Mike.
Good night to my friends Chuck and Lorraine. Stay warm down there. And so, good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. Good night, Emily Parker. Good night, Ben Wheeler. Good night, Crystal Campbell. Good night, Nancy Lanza. Good night, James Foley and Stephen Sotloff. Good night, Charlie Hebdo. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.